welcome to the podcast of Renew Lehigh Valley's Brown Bag Discussion Series. I'm Stephen Bliss, Executive Director of Renew Lehigh Valley, and this is the recording of the March 2010 Brown Bag event. These Brown Bags are an ongoing series of informal discussions of issues related to urban revitalization, smart growth, and regional collaboration. This session looked at redevelopment efforts in the Lehigh Valley, and in particular, at the work of municipal redevelopment authorities in the cities of Allentown, Bethlehem, and Easton. The panelists for this session, in the order in which you'll hear them, included Chad Helmer, Senior Project Manager at Taggart Associates. He's currently Project Manager for the Bushkill Creek Corridor Revitalization Project in Easton. Also, John Rohall, Executive Director of the Redevelopment Authority of the City of Bethlehem, and Karen Beck-Pooley, Executive Director of the Redevelopment Authority of the City of Allentown. The session was held on Friday, March 12, 2010, at the Lehigh Valley Heritage Center in Allentown. We welcome your comments and feedback, so please send your input to us at smartgrowth@renewlv.org. Thanks for listening. Again, thanks for being here today. The focus today is on redevelopment efforts across the three cities. I'll do more detailed introductions of the panelists as we get to them, but we have Chad Helmer from Taggart Associates speaking about the Simone Silk Mill project in Easton, John Rohall, Executive Director of the Redevelopment Authority in the City of Bethlehem, will be speaking about the efforts in that city and also more broadly about some of the issues that go into redevelopment, and Karen Beck-Pooley, Executive Director of the Redevelopment Authority in the City of Allentown, will be talking about their efforts with a specific focus on some of the blighted property rehabilitation efforts that they've been doing in the city. With that, I want to introduce Chad Helmer, who will be our first speaker. Chad is a Senior Project Manager at Taggart Associates in Bethlehem. He currently serves as the Project Manager for the Bushkill Creek Corridor Revitalization Project, a series of interrelated projects along an appropriately two-mile stretch of the Bushkill Creek in the city of Easton. The project encompasses, along with various other components, the redevelopment of the former Simone Silk Mill, one of the most ambitious brownfield projects in the Lehigh Valley region. From 2000 to 2004, Chad was Director of Land Recycling with the Lehigh Valley Economic Development Corporation, where he facilitated multiple commercial and industrial redevelopment projects throughout Lehigh and Northampton counties. Chad earned a Bachelor of Science in Environmental Resource Management with a focus on environmental and renewable resource economics from Penn State. And so I'm going to turn the mic figuratively over to Chad. And the idea is each of them will speak for about 10, 15 minutes or so, and then there'll be a Q&A and discussion following all three of the presentations.
Thanks very much, Steve. I'm very glad to be here today, speaking on behalf of the Redevelopment Authority in Easton in particular, regarding the Bushkill Creek Corridor project, and a little bit more specifically on the redevelopment plans for the Simone Silk Mill. I'm sort of pinch-hitting a bit today, I guess, for Gretchen Lippincott, who is the Executive Director of the Redevelopment Authority over there. In Easton, she's out of town today, so I guess you're sort of stuck with me, so I will do my best pinch hitting for her. I have been involved in the project for several years, though, so hopefully I will do a good job in her place. Just to orient you a little bit on the Bushkill Creek Corridor project as a whole, as Stephen said in the introduction, the Bushkill Creek Corridor project is a series of interrelated projects, both economic development and recreational development projects, along the Bushkill Creek in the city of Easton. Just to orient you a little bit, there's two sort of primary nodes, one of which is the Simone Silk Mill, which is at the western end, which is along North 13th Street. At the other end is the North 3rd Street area, which if those of you who frequent Easton might be well aware that Lafayette College owns most of those properties and is actually actively engaged in constructing redevelopment work along there. The Bushkill Creek connects these two areas, and really serves as the foundation for the corridor project as a whole. It was originally envisioned in approximately 2004, and actually, if you want to talk about being originally envisioned, probably goes well back further than that. But the project as it's sort of constructed today was put together in approximately 2004 by City of Easton, the Easton Redevelopment Authority, Lafayette College, and the DNL Heritage Corridor as the three primary partners, the three legs of which are the redevelopment of the mill, the work that the college is doing along 3rd Street, and the development of a recreational trail that will not only connect those two areas, but will also extend down through the downtown and ultimately connect to Riverside Park, which the city is also in the process of doing a large-scale upgrade to that park as well. I should mention just briefly that the project is the subject of a relatively large RCAP grant that was leveraged primarily based upon the private investments of Lafayette College in the corridor. So they are a strong partner in the corridor project. I'm going to focus most of the rest of my comments on the Simone Silk Mill, which is a project that is being spearheaded primarily by the city and the Easton Redevelopment Authority. I should mention I see Becky Bradley's here today as well, so hopefully if you have any questions for her, she's the Director of Planning and Codes with the city, so hopefully we can tag team any questions that you might have. So this is a historic photo of the mill. It was originally constructed in the 1880s by the R&H Simone Silk Manufacturing Company. As I mentioned, it's along North 13th Street, just north of the 13th Street interchange on Route 22. The initial buildings were built in the 1880s and multiple construction phases up through the 1960s. Property grew to contain 19 buildings, about 334,000 square feet of space. And at one time, just an interesting sort of historical tidbit, at one time the R&H Simone Silk Company was the largest manufacturer of black silk ribbon in the entire world. The mill stopped operating in around the middle of the 20th century when many of the textile mills throughout this part of the country were sort of on the way of ramping down. And the last thing I wanted to mention from a historical standpoint is that we have had some historical surveys done, and the complex is eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. So this is an aerial shot of what the mill looks like pretty much today. And just to orient you, we're now looking eastward. You can see 13th Street is in the foreground. And as I mentioned, the mill's about 19 buildings, many of which are connected together. A mix of three- and four-story mill buildings, as well as some one- and two-story sawtooth roof buildings that you can see there as well. Next couple of slides are just some photos to give you a kind of feel for the mill itself. This picture shows Bushkill Creek in the foreground. The Bushkill Creek is a high-quality cold water fishery, so it's a nice attribute to have for the site. It also has some very interesting interior outdoor spaces. The buildings were constructed around several different courtyards, so there's some interesting opportunities for outdoor rooms, if you will, to be incorporated into the redevelopment of the property. This is a sort of pretty representative photo of the interior of the mill. As you know, folks who are familiar with older mill buildings, this is probably fairly representative of a lot of older mill structures. Relatively open floor plans with either one or dual row of columns that run down the center. They're, as I mentioned, they're very flexible in the type of reuse that they might have, lots of natural light, things of that nature. Just to give you a little bit of history on the actual redevelopment of the mill in particular and how it fits into the corridor project, the Redevelopment Authority, who actually owns the mill today, acquired the property towards the end of 2006 with the intent of facilitating some type of mixed-use redevelopment. They moved quickly to put out an RFP for private sector developers to engage them in the project. And frankly, at the time, there was relatively little interest from the private sector expressed in the project. After their RFP process concluded and the Redevelopment Authority decided not to move forward based upon the level of interest, they decided to sort of take a step back and talk to the developers and the private sector and say, what's stopping you from jumping into this project? What's holding you back? And there was really a series of different things that they heard. One was that we ultimately found out that the RFP process was sort of, unfortunately, at the very beginning of the downturn in the real estate market. The developers were seeing that sort of starting to come to fruition, so folks were starting to get a little less confident about moving forward with any type of project, let alone one as complex as this. The second thing was that they felt like that there was enough unknowns about the project that it was a bit risky for them to be willing to jump in with both feet and take the lead to serve as master developer. And the third thing was that they were interested in knowing more about what the community wanted to see happen at the site. The first RFP was left relatively open-ended, and the idea was that that we would let the private sector really tell us what they thought would work at the site. As it turned out, several developers said, you know, we really want to have a better feel for what the community wants to see happen here before we expend a lot of resources developing a plan. We want to make sure that it's something that will fly, in essence, in Easton as a community. So at that point, the Redevelopment Authority reevaluated its role in the process and really decided to commit to taking a much more active role in the redevelopment of the site. And what that entailed was completing a lot more due diligence on the site, both environmental, structural analyses, things like that, to be able to provide that information to the developers up front. So it would be something that they would not have to expend prior to knowing if they were even interested in moving forward with the project. And perhaps even more importantly, the city and the Redevelopment Authority engaged in a fairly detailed and elaborate community involvement process that talked to stakeholders, talked to representatives of the community, talked to various folks to really engage them in the planning process for what they wanted to see happen there. Through that process, I don't have the time to get into everything that they went through that process. It's probably a presentation unto itself. But to make a long story short, the plan that was ultimately developed, or the concept, I should say, was to have the mill adaptively reused for mixed-use integrated complex, focused on the advancement of sustainable and what we were terming creative industries. Creative industries, as we were defining it, was not necessarily just arts, not necessarily just arts as maybe the layperson traditionally might think of the arts, painting, sculpting, things of that nature, but also a broad range of arts and creative industries that might include architects, studios, multimedia, computer folks, programming, things of that nature. So basically at that point, the market study was completed, as well as a physical facilities analysis to determine, one, is there a market for this type of use in this area? And two, can the site handle these type of uses, and how might that play out? So basically the rest of the slides that I'm going to go through are really the results of that physical feasibility study and site plan that was developed. It was developed by a team led by Spillman Farmer Architects. An engineer on their team was CMX, and Lee Saltzman Architects is a historic rehab architect firm that was on their team as well. So I'm going to try and move kind of pretty quickly through the next couple of slides. They're pretty visual. So here's the rendering that Spillman Farmer developed, which is really the basis of the rest of the slides. They referred their plan as SILC, a creative community. So that's sort of the term that we're using to refer to the plan. I should point out that the entire Spillman Farmer report is on the front page of the city's website, so I encourage anybody who's interested could go to www.easton-pa.gov. And if you just scroll down a little bit, there's a link that you can actually pull the whole report off if you're interested. So the key concepts of the SILC plan, basically, as I mentioned before, is an integrated complex of buildings dedicated to the creative industries, mix of residential, retail, commercial, office space, variety of educational and cultural options as part of the site as well. Hopefully, it could be a community that generates creative, intellectual, and economic capital. Obviously, the city wants this project to serve as an economic engine for the community, both via the creation of jobs as well as the ultimate creation of additional tax revenue, and obviously a place where folks want to be and spend time. The plan that they put together, and I won't go through this in gory detail, but it had several zones. From a planning standpoint, they broke it into a couple of different zones to make it a little bit easier to think about. The next series of slides just kind of show some visual depictions of the various zones, but they gave the zones names, called them the mix, the cultural core, art home, which is some artistically designed residential spaces, the think tank, which is where the sawtooth roof buildings are, which might be space for some actual light manufacturing and things of that nature. So this shows a gateway, computer-generated image of the site. This is 13th Street in the foreground. And there's an intent is to have a central boulevard that runs down the center of the property. The mix, termed so because it's probably got the most diverse mix of uses in that zone, some of which involve these immediate buildings that you can see here. Along the boulevard, this is looking back towards 13th Street, would have retail and commercial uses on the first floor and residential spaces on the second floor. This image also shows something that Spillman Farmer has proposed for different locations throughout the site, which is the actual construction of some new construction, which is incorporated into the existing structures in a very context-sensitive way. The cultural core, which is primarily the base of where the arts-based uses would be on the site. This is a cutaway to show the three structures that are that make up the cultural core. You can see the building all the way to your left is the old boiler house. These are large, open-space buildings that are very flexible and provide, you know, lots of different diversity of potential uses. One, for example, is possible small theater performance space inside the boiler house as a potential use. This is a depiction of one of those interesting interior spaces. It's a similar view to one of the photos I showed before. You can see an interior courtyard that provides interesting opportunities for public gathering spaces, festivals, things like that. The cutaway of the art home zone. You can see how this is a two-story sawtooth roof building that's proposed for some residential spaces with public spaces in the hallways and maybe a community meeting area that might be have incorporated some sculptures or art galleries. The think tank, as I mentioned before, is within some very large open spaces in those sawtooth roof buildings that might provide actual space for some light manufacturing or some production space. Just getting to some of the design standards, essentially because the project will likely be developed through multiple phases and through possibly through multiple developers, Spillman Farmer suggested certain design elements to be carried out throughout the entirety of the project to kind of keep a consistent design on site. These are just some of them that they suggested, from the use of industrial materials, integrated landscape designs, character-defining interiors, creative use of older materials that might be already on site. Obviously, treating the windows as historically as possible, and integrated signage and wayfinding throughout the site. So, just kind of wrapping up, they provided a fairly detailed phasing plan of multiple phases of the project, some of which might actually happen concurrently. They're not necessarily doesn't necessarily need to happen in six separate phases. Perhaps certain ones would happen at the same time. But as you can see, the intent is that it would happen as several different construction phases, the first of which includes what we're terming an A and a B. Phase 1A would be primarily infrastructure work that would serve the rest of the site. As you can see, I mentioned the main boulevard that would run through the heart of the property. It would also include the installation of some gateway signage, other utilities, things of that nature along the spine, including a central energy plant that would be in one of the buildings. And the second part of phase one would be the development of building A and B, which are some of the buildings that would be along 13th Street at the corner of the entryway. That would be about 39,000 square feet as part of what we're terming the initial phase of the project. And we're probably going to be seeking private development partners in some fashion, which is still to be determined a little bit, probably in sometime this year, in hopes that we might be able to move towards construction of both phase one or phase 1A and phase 1B, hopefully in 2010-2011 timeframe. So I included Gretchen Lippincott's contact information. You can certainly contact her if you have any questions or would like to learn more about the project. As I mentioned, Becky Bradley with the city of Easton is sort of leading the charge on the development of the trail portion of it. So if you have any comments or questions about that part of it, she's here, and I'm sure she wouldn't mind if you got in touch with her as well. Or if you have any questions for me, I'm here as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Chad. What I also should mention, and I should have mentioned up front, is that the PowerPoint presentations from today will be on our multimedia page for download along with the podcast. So there's a single page where you can get all the information from the brown bags in one place if you want to get a copy of the presentation. Thank you, Chad. Our next speaker is John Rohal. John is executive director of the Redevelopment Authority for the City of Bethlehem and has been with the authority since 1972. John has served on numerous nonprofit boards over the course of the years, including that of the Community Action Committee of the Lehigh Valley, or CACLV, which many of you know was the organization that RenewLV was founded under and ultimately spun off of as our own organization. He is also a founding member of the Lehigh Valley Community Land Trust. John's professional interests center on development, housing, and disability-related issues. John was involved in coaching youth sports for 20 years, but now spends much of his summer leisure time enjoying the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs. His other personal interests are in history and Penn State and Lehigh University football. John holds a BA and a MA from Lehigh University. John.
Thanks, Steve. I was happy to accept this invitation. I have to admit, I was thrilled when I walked in this room because one of my interests, too, is the Civil War. And when I rolled out of bed this morning, I never believed I'd be that close to General George Greene's frock coat. Any of you who are familiar with Battle of Gettysburg, he did at Culp's Hill at the other end of the Fish Hook, kind of what Joshua Chamberlain did up at Little Round Top. But Chamberlain wrote about it afterward and was a prolific writer and politician. His story is known. Greene is kind of hidden. But going back to the subject at hand, the Redevelopment Authority, I had talked to Karen a little earlier in the week, and I'm going to concentrate on some general things and some history in Bethlehem to try to give you a little background. Now, a lot of that will relate to what she talks about in specific projects in Allentown and kind of relates what Chad did in the excellent presentation he just made of a specific project in Easton. In Bethlehem, the Redevelopment Authority was actually chartered under the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania back in 1953. So it's a long-standing organization. The law that redevelopment authorities operate under in Pennsylvania was actually first passed in 1945, the Urban Redevelopment Law. It's been amended many times since. The underlying theme of all redevelopment authorities, really the legal basis under which we work, is the curing and elimination of blight. Anything that we do is supposed to be related to elimination of blight on properties. And that gets to be very important when we talk about some of the controversies that have evolved in Beltham and somewhat Pennsylvania and throughout the nation. One of the powers redevelopment authorities have is eminent domain. And the difference between eminent domain as a redevelopment authority can use it and as a city would is the city is required to use it for only public reuses. A redevelopment authority, under certain conditions, can seize property under eminent domain and turn around and sell it for private reuse. Some of you may be familiar with a Supreme Court case that happened a few years ago in which it was called Kelo versus City of New London. And in that decision, which was quite controversial, the Supreme Court ruled on a 5-4 basis that eminent domain could be used for economic development purposes. Well, when that happened, which was something that would be in favor of economic development corporations and the like, there was a huge hue and cry nationwide. And even though the economic development side basically won a very close Supreme Court decision, the end result of that is many states and the federal government put stricter usage requirements on the use of eminent domain. Some of it was done by changes of state law, as what's happened in Pennsylvania, made it harder to use. Some of it was done on the national level by restrictions on the use of federal funds. So my opinion on eminent domain is something that it's kind of like the 60-rule vote that's being argued in the Senate. If you're in power and you agree with the use of the eminent domain, you're going to support it. There are many people, though, when you're out of power or disagree with the use that are going to oppose it. I look at it as a tool. It has good and bad points, but let me just talk about it in general like that. Going into the specifics of Beltham, the use of eminent domain and the type of redevelopment projects that traditionally happen in Beltham have changed very much over the years. If you go back into the 1960s, there were area-wide redevelopment projects, and they centered in both the north and south side. They were in the area on the south side of Lehigh University and the Beltham Steel Plant. On the north side of Beltham, they were in the downtown. And a lot of people forget the Monoxie Creek area where the historic area is now and also the area of the green space where Music Fest exists. That was an old redevelopment project that highly used eminent domain. One of the big things, these were highly controversial at the time, and one of the big things that has changed is that they were used on not only on an area-wide basis as opposed to individual properties, but they took active residences and commercial establishments. So you can imagine, thinking back 40 years ago, that you weren't taking out blighted vacant properties like we do now, and as I think Karen will talk about in a few minutes, but you're talking about moving active neighborhoods, businesses where you may not have thought they were the best use, but they were certainly viable businesses in many cases. And to the people within those businesses, they were sometimes their cherished way of earning a living. Much of that has changed over the years. Again, there were various factors, but I think overall the economic climate has changed, also the political climate, and the way these sorts of projects were funded. Back in the 1960s, the federal government and to some degree the state government were providing categorical grants for urban renewal. Today, much of the money that we get does not come from categorical grants, but it's funneled through the Community Development Block Grant program. Now, that was changed in the mid-1970s, and interestingly, I would say at least it was a correlation, not necessarily a cause, but at that time, was about the same time the whole approach to renewal, downtown development, and things was changing. Beltham changed with that, and I think probably it was a good thing. We moved away from large-scale demolition of downtown areas to things like preservation and supporting that preservation with wise use of public funds. Our Main Street corridor, I think, is a prime example of that today. I think it's one of the better small business districts in the Lehigh Valley, and it certainly was a use, in my opinion, of innovative support of private development on the site by supporting renovation of the building and supporting it with public improvements in the area as opposed to tearing down a vast block. At one time, portion of Main Street was scheduled to be torn down, and I think to everyone's happiness today, that really didn't happen. When we go through the 1970s, the movement of redevelopment and community development basically moved into pretty much what's happening today. Karen's going to go into some detail of how eminent domain is largely used today on scattered site-type properties. In the past, as I said, you would certify an area as being blighted. That still happens, but the end result isn't necessarily demolition today. Where demolition usually happens in today's environment is where a property is identified as an individual property with blighted conditions. By and large, it's vacant as part of the process, which makes it a lot more palatable politically to go after these things. And you basically go into a blighted property review committee, and then it's certified by the Planning Commission. Bethlehem's planning director is here. And once it's certified as blighted, you can use eminent domain. That tends to be a lot less controversial than when you were going in and moving active businesses or residences. A couple of the other things that we can do today and still do are borrowing funds. It's not used as much in a general sense by every redevelopment authority, but we do have the right to borrow money and then turn around and relend it. Significantly, unless the city guarantees it, the debt isn't counted against the city's debt limitation. So that can be important at times, although if in some cases the city guarantees the loan, the money is, or the amount of the loan is counted against the debt limitation. One of the main things that we're working on in Bethlehem today, which is fairly innovative, it certainly was in the Lehigh Valley when we were the first ones to do it in the Lehigh Valley, but it's called a tax incremental financing district. And let's move to the Bethlehem Steel properties, the old Bethlehem Steel plant. This is probably the biggest thing that the Bethlehem Redevelopment Authority is involved now as a redevelopment authority. And where I'm talking about is a district that's roughly a little bit east of the Fahey Bridge, which is New Street going across the river, to a little bit west of the Mincy Trail Bridge. And if you look at it today, that's where basically the casino and the new parking garage exists. 10 years ago, the city, school district, and county created what's known as a tax incremental financing district in that area. And at the time, basically, the three elected taxing bodies felt that without significant public support, nothing was going to happen there. If any of you have ever traveled around to different places in the United States, one of the worst brownfields you can imagine is an old heavy industrial plant that's been sitting there for 15 or 20 years. There's a barbed wire fence around the outside. The buildings are falling in. Metal's rusting. It's just a horrible situation. Well, with good foresight, the people, the elected officials about 10 years ago in Bethlehem agreed that something had to be done about this plant. One of the fortunate things also about this situation in Bethlehem was at the time, Bethlehem Steel Corporation was still being managed by executives who had local roots here, and they too saw the importance of doing something about this plant. One of the big changes, and just to digress a little bit, is many companies now, the executive management is not centered in the town you live in. The fact that Bethlehem Steel had its corporate headquarters here and many of these people were residents in the area made them very progressive in seeing that something positive should be done about this brownfield. Much of the work, the original parts of this work, were done prior to the year 2000. Many of the plans and things were actually commissioned by Bethlehem Steel when they were still a corporate entity and were highly interested in redoing this. They worked in a partnership with the city of what they called Bethlehem Works at the time. They hired many planners and consultants at their expense. They also did much of the demolition in that area of properties that were not historically significant. The city came into it, both the city government and the redevelopment authority, to play an active partnership role in this, and that continues today, even though Bethlehem Steel is long out of the picture. Not to use all the time here because I know Karen has an interesting story, but I'm going to skip over a lot of the mechanics of what happened between Bethlehem Steel and Sands, but only to say that some other development partners came into the picture and brought in Las Vegas Sands Corporation, which became the big economic engine that drove the rest of that redevelopment, and that continues today. You all are probably following the stories of how the hotel was delayed and things. We're hoping that comes back into fruition with the approval of table games. And, of course, this is an ongoing story. As you probably saw, there was a hearings in Bethlehem yesterday, and the city government at least is hopeful that the hotel and hopefully the commercial buildings around there become reestablished with the advent of the table games. Basically, that's the major project we're doing as the Redevelopment Authority, anticipated in the next year and hopefully in the coming months, will be roughly a $25 to $30 million bond issue using the tax incremental financing. Now, I kind of glossed over that, but basically the concept of tax incremental financing is that there's a base assessment of the raw undeveloped land. Let's say that value is X. When the new development happens on that land, you get an increase assessment. Just for the sake of discussion today, well, let's call that Y. So the school district, county, and city would have collected X on that land in terms of tax revenue. Now, when we went to talk to them at the time, we convinced them that nothing would happen unless you put some public funds in there to do things like infrastructure and other public improvements. Now, this is where the Y comes in. They believed that if we did some of these improvements and found a way to support the private development in the site, the new assessment level would raise by that Y. And they were that strong a believer in it, the elected officials at the time, that they were willing to commit that Y piece for 20 years, up to 20 years, to support those public improvements. Now, we can all talk about planning and things, but all of this stuff comes down to money in the end. But this type of an approach basically gave us the ability to put those public improvements in and pay for them by the taxes that would have been generated out of the project itself. We did not have to go back to the taxing bodies and ask them for some of their existing taxes. What we asked them for was to defer and give us some of the new taxes they would get. The benefit to them, at the end of the period of time, they will get all the taxes that are coming out of the project. There's a cap on that. TIF district, it's 20 years, but we're actually 10 years into it. So anything that's happening now, the full tax revenues will accrue to the taxing bodies in a 10-year period. I guess I've taken up pretty much time. One of my other interests that isn't really necessarily tied directly to the Redevelopment Authority, but it's to my professional job, is housing, affordable housing. I'm chairperson of the Lehigh Valley Coalition on Affordable Housing. As Steve said, we are also doing something called the Lehigh Valley Community Land Trust, which I think is a pretty exciting concept. I would hope your group could bring them in here someday and do a full presentation on that. I can't do justice to it in the next 2 minutes, but I think it's something that is going to provide affordable housing in the Lehigh Valley in a general sense. I'm not talking about public housing necessarily. I'm talking about ownership situations in a shared equity basis. It's an exciting concept, and I think it's a very valuable tool that hopefully will bring some good benefits to all of us. And on that note, I'm going to turn it back to Steve.
Thank you, John. And next up we have Karen Pooley, Karen Beck Pooley, I should say, from the City of Allentown. Karen is the Executive Director of the Redevelopment Authority in the City of Allentown. She has been in that position since 2007. She has also served as an associate at CZB, an urban planning and neighborhood development consulting firm, a research associate at the Institute for Children in Poverty, and deputy director of the Third Party Transfer and Tax Lien Sale Unit at New York City's Department of Housing Preservation and Development. Karen received a PhD from the University of Pennsylvania's Department of City and Regional Planning in 2007. She has a BA in Political Science from Wellesley and a Master of Urban Planning and Policy from the New School University's Milano Graduate School. Karen.
Thank you. All right, I'm going to talk a little bit about the unsung side of Redevelopment Authority work. And I really appreciate John's intro because a lot of the history that he gave feeds right into the bulk of the work that we're doing right now. I will end with an exciting project, and I apologize for all my ugly buildings you'll get to see in the interim. But as John mentioned, the mission of the Redevelopment Authority, a real intent of Redevelopment Authorities, is to prevent and eliminate blight. And we're tasked with doing that in the city of Allentown. We're a state-created entity, and we're empowered to do what we do by state law. And as those state laws change, just as John described, the way in which we can use tools like eminent domain also changes. So we're tasked with preventing and eliminating blight in the city of Allentown. And just before I get into how we do that, I want to describe how my job is actually easier than many people might think. Allentown's fairly unique among Pennsylvania cities in that if you look at our population from 1950 to when the most recent data is available, 2008, basically today, our population has stayed constant. All through that time, where the purple line sort of stays steady on that graph. In contrast, similar cities throughout Pennsylvania have lost substantial portions of their residents. In the case of Reading, they've lost about a quarter of their residents. Harrisburg and Scranton, over 40% of their residents. And the challenge that comes from population loss is that when residents leave, they can't take their housing with them. And if no one's coming in behind them, then you're left with a larger vacant and abandoned property stock. And that's exactly the case that we monitor very closely because these are the properties that we're charged with watching over. We monitor closely properties in the city of Allentown that are tagged unfit for human habitation or designated as unsafe structures. We watch those carefully. The number and the list of those properties changes all the time because owners are always fixing properties up and new properties are always falling into disrepair. But my best guess is that we've got around 200, certainly no more than 300 properties in our city that would qualify as severely blighted and abandoned. That's about 1% of our housing stock, which in the grand scheme of things is not that much at all. Reading did a recent survey of their entire housing stock, and here in a city that's smaller than Allentown, found about 1,400 abandoned structures. So, you know, on a scale of 4 to 5 times the amount of structures that we've got, they've got are abandoned. That represents about 6% of their housing stock. Philly, for just a completely other universe of abandoned properties, did a survey early in 2000, found 60,000 vacant structures. Many of them are vacant lots, but a good 27,000 of those are vacant structures. That's about 10% of their housing stock. So, again, in the grand scheme of things, our blighted and abandoned property problem is not that bad. It's a manageable problem that you can get your hands around. That being said, it's manageable right now. If it were something that we ignored, it could very easily become an unmanageable problem. And so we take it very seriously, and we've been very aggressive over the last few years in getting at properties that are the most distressed. Here are some of the properties that we've targeted that are either currently targeted or have gone through our blighted property process. As John described, over time, what qualified as a blighted property or a blighted area was a fairly subjective determination. State law has tightened that quite a bit, and the way that we can classify a property as blighted, it has to meet at least one of 12 specific criteria that are outlined in state law. There's irrefutable, very objective criteria like being unfit for human habitation, having no plumbing. These are not criteria that everyone can agree actually cause problems not only to properties but to neighborhoods. And so these are the type of properties that come through our process. I didn't initiate Allentown's blighted property review process. This had started. We ran our first list. I did not, but the Redevelopment Authority introduced our first list of blighted properties back in 2001. What I did, though, when I came was get this process on a regular calendar. It is designed to take a while. This is not an acquisition strategy. It's more of a code enforcement strategy. Most of the properties, probably 70% of the properties that enter this process, get removed over the course of our administrative back and forth with property owners as they make property improvements. Our sole ability to condemn these properties is based on the condition of them. So as soon as owners improve their properties and fix those problems, we're no longer empowered to condemn them using eminent domain. So in about 75% of cases, owners, once they finally get letters from us, even if they've ignored all the violation notices and the various citations that have come before my letter, sometimes it's my letter that's just enough to encourage people to actually address some of these problems. So most of the properties drop off over the course of our administrative process. That administrative process runs about a year. So there's ample time in that process for owners to comply. We just we initiate a new list every March. We just did that on Monday. And as John described, it has to go before two separate committees, a Blighted Property Review Committee and an Allentown City Planning Commission. On two separate occasions, they hear testimony from our code enforcement officials as to why these properties are classified as blighted. It also has to go before the Redevelopment Authority's own board and before City Council. And all of that, we purposely insert, we're obligated to insert a certain amount of time in between meetings, but we purposely maybe add a month or so in between meetings beyond what we're obligated to do to give owners the opportunity to respond to these problems. Where they don't, at the end of our administrative process, once we get City Council's blessing, which we're slated to get on another list next week, then we're empowered to prepare for the legal side of condemnation and actually transfer title from these problematic owners to the Redevelopment Authority. And again, in terms of scale here, if we're facing at any one moment maybe 200 or 300 problematic properties throughout the city of Allentown, in 2008, 2009, and again this year, we've involved maybe 30 to 40 properties in this process. Again, most of which have been fixed as a result of that, some of which have been actually acquired by the Redevelopment Authority. But our expectation is doing that at that kind of scale for a handful of years, not indefinitely, but the next 5 to 10 years, will not only get rid of the backlog of properties that have looked like this for a very long time, but will also discourage and prevent new properties from getting this bad. It's an effective code enforcement tool because now the code enforcement officials who are going out and issuing violations can let owners know that at the end of the process, if those violations aren't corrected, there's this threat of condemnation where property literally changes title. One issue which would come as no surprise based on what's going on in the housing market, we found that on the list of properties that ran through our process in 2009, 30% of them, fully 30%, were involved in the foreclosure process at some point in that process. Either were abandoned by their owner and reverted to banks at some point over the course of our year, or were bank-owned when they entered our process. That's foreclosure is a big issue here. It's a big issue nationwide. This is just showing how many properties were eligible for sheriff sale, which is where foreclosed properties either transfer to a new owner or revert back to the bank. It's run through the sheriff's office, the county sheriff's office. Over the course of last year, there were typically about 120 to 150 properties eligible at each sale. That's not additive because properties might be continued to the next month, but at a given, but that was high. At the beginning of this year, we've seen lists more like 230 and 240. So that's certainly an issue that we'll continue to grapple with. Another big program we've been running that is complementary to our blighted property review process is the administering of neighborhood stabilization program funds that the city received. That's a federal program. Allentown's allocation came from the last administration, last federal administration. It was awarded in 2008. And that money is designed to acquire bank-owned properties and get them back into productive use. So far, we've acquired or expect to close shortly on about 13 properties, all of which were not only bank-owned but had some serious violations also. So that helped us sort of double up on what we could have achieved through our blighted property process this year. After a slow start, working with banks is not an easy task, but I think they're getting to the point where they realize that row homes in Allentown are not actually worth $1 million, and it behooves them to get some of these properties off of their books sooner rather than later. As I've said, our blighted property process is really a code enforcement kind of tool that we are just sort of the back-end hammer. We work closely with the city's Bureau of Building Standards and Safety. Their inspectors are the ones identifying and recommending properties to our process, and they help us monitor them as we run through the process. The acquisition of blighted properties is important. That certainly helps get over the hurdle of a stubborn and uncooperative property owner. But if we don't have a good disposition strategy for those properties, we really haven't solved the whole problem. We've made a point of, as properties do come into our inventory, being clear on where they're headed next, and we're also working closely with the Bureau of Building Standards and Safety on their new homesteading program here in Allentown. They've had a program here in the past. It's been dormant for probably about 10 or 15 years. It's being revived now. And the idea is that properties that come into our inventory could be funneled towards this. We're, in fact, going to be advertising a number of properties that are eligible for the homesteading program at tomorrow's Homebuyer Supermarket. But the idea is that our donation to that effort is the property, and then the entire extent of the money that a future owner or homesteader is able to borrow can go not towards the purchase of that property, but instead towards the rehab. And so that's a great way that beyond working with our community development and for-profit developer partners to rehab our homes, we now have added capacity through the homesteading program. And all of these properties that are appropriate for single-family homes, and as they funnel through our inventory, go towards homeowners. Some of the properties have remained single-family homes. Many of them that come into our inventory have been chopped up into multiple units. As they come out of our inventory, all are rehabbed back into single-family homes. So it's a way that we can remove blighting influences on the neighborhood. We can de-densify in some cases. And it helps my back end helps strengthen the prevention on the front end. And I just have up there, the more aggressive our code enforcement officials are on the prevention side of things, the easier my job is too. So I help them and collaborate with them on as many ideas as they can come up with to be aggressive about property inspections and calling out problematic owners, which they have done a fabulous job at. But while most of my properties are small, appropriate for single-family homes, those aren't the only properties in Allentown that are blighted. We have run some commercial lists. And this property, which is the Neuweiler Brewery at Front and Gordon Street, was fully condemned and is now owned by the Redevelopment Authority back at the end of last year. This property ran through our blighted property process. Violations on it go back to about the 1970s, I think. But it's wonderful to hear stories like the Silk Project in Easton. While we're about 3 years behind where you are, we haven't done any of the planning about where this property is going next. We have high hopes for it. It's a beautiful building, and I think because we've now taken ownership and have more control over where the property is going next, have an opportunity to rehab it and reuse it in a very creative way. So thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Karen, and really to all our panelists. We have some time for questions and also for some comments. There are, I know, a number of practitioners and also involved community members in the audience, so any questions or comments for the panel, and I'll bring the mic to you if you have anything. Of course, it's always the farthest person from me that starts.
It's actually very interesting that you bring that up, and it's something that I didn't focus a lot of attention on in my presentation, but it definitely is something that's a pretty significant thought process as far as the silk mill goes. We have thought through various ways that we can encourage developers as well as to support the use of sustainable energy, use of new and creative stormwater technologies, things like that to make the redevelopment of the Silk Mill project as green as possible, I guess to use a somewhat overused term. There's been thought of incorporating the use of geothermal technologies, the sawtooth roofs, actually because of the way they're oriented, folks who have some expertise in that tell us that they would be potentially almost ideal candidates for some type of solar technology, whether it would be, you know, PV cells or, solar hot water, things of that nature. So, yes, it's a very apropos comment, and it's something that the Redevelopment Authority is definitely incorporating into their thought process for the redevelopment of the site, and we'll certainly be encouraging private sector developers to participate in those type of elements as well. Whether we can actually hit specific LEED certification standards remains to be seen, and whether we'll actually pursue, whether it be silver, gold, whatever levels might actually be hit. We have to go through that process to see, whether we can actually hit LEED certification standards and whether developers are willing to participate to that level. So I can't, guarantee you here today that it would hit certain LEED standards, but definitely the incorporation of sustainable energy and green technologies is something the Redevelopment Authority is taking very seriously and working hard to incorporate into the plans.
Yes, it's posted on our website. The bulk, we have mapped them. The bulk of them are focused in our core target area, which is sort of Center City, Allentown. But we have, there are a few properties that extend outside of that, way out on the, pretty much in every corridor. We've got one out as far as 18th Street. And then we've got one out on South Front Street and then on Club Avenue. I think most of our efforts, though, happen, are just right sort of in the central city. The City of Allentown received about $2 million, and that is all reserved for the acquisition of bank-owned properties. So that is very limited.
That's certainly a very interesting interesting concept. It's I think it's something that, well, I can't speak for the Redevelopment Authority itself as far as its willingness to entertain that type of option. It certainly sounds like something that I would imagine if they could put a plan in place, it would be something that they might consider. I think we might be a little premature in our stage of the project to. There hasn't been a lot of discussion about that to date, but I'm sure Gretchen Lippincott with the Redevelopment Authority and her colleagues at the city would certainly be at least interested in having some discussions about the opportunities there. Yeah, definitely. I think between the actual post-development jobs that we all hope are very plentiful on the site, there's obviously it's the redevelopment of the site as a whole, while it will be done in phases, we're thinking will be somewhere on the order of between $50 and $100 million. That's a pretty significant construction project, particularly for the eastern part of the valley. And I think to the extent that folks from the city of Easton can benefit from both the jobs on site as well as construction jobs, certainly would benefit the community.
I think it's more of an ongoing process. It changes in the focus, but there's plenty of buildings out there right now that are slowly deteriorating. When you look at housing in particular, there's a lot of housing right now that's still valuable. Whether it's going to be useful in 50 years, I don't know. When you start looking at materials, bricks are like cookies in a way, as a person in Bethlehem describes it. When that outer shell starts breaking down and you get to the soft part, what do you do with that building? I mean, there are ways you can restore some of it, but is it worth the cost? It's kind of what I was talking about moving people out and things. The easy ones to justify are the vacant structures, whether they be the small or the big, as we've seen both today. I mean, there's not a lot of controversy, but when you start talking about having to go back and moving out active businesses or houses with people in them, then you have to make some really serious value judgments. What's the best thing to do? With the Lehigh Valley Community Land Trust, I was out earlier this week with Brian George, the director of that, and I'm on the site selection committee to acquire these properties. And we were looking at, we probably reviewed about 9 different houses that we at least saw the exterior. We went in most of them. And even among ourselves, there was some disagreement. Should this house be saved? Is it worth putting another $40,000 in and move a family in, or would it be better to tear it down? Again, getting back to your question, I think that question is always going to be asked, and the people at the time are going to have to make value judgments of what to do. One of the things, and I don't want to get into this any detail because it probably won't come through the Redevelopment Authority of Bethlehem, but one property in Bethlehem, the biggest one we have that's vacant and probably blighted in a way, is Martin Tower. Now, nobody thinks that property is blighted because it looks good from the outside. But from an economic perspective, to try to make that thing usable and do all the asbestos removal, put in the fire suppression systems that are necessary, restructure it since it's not going to be used as a single corporate office anymore, you have to throw millions of dollars into that building. And it's a value judgment that's really tough to make because from the outside, no one would ever think that building is blighted or even have a negative effect on the neighborhood. Allow it to stay vacant for another 20 years, though, without a reuse. I suspect people will look at it slightly differently.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think, first of all, in terms of our blighted property process, my hope is I don't expect that to ever go away, but if we're running 30 or 40 properties through it now in 10 years, I would hope that we'd be running 5 to 10, maybe. That's the hope with that one. And I think as that kind of enforcement along with upped prevention on the housing side of things, the housing stock in Allentown, there'll be less for me to do related to that stock. I think it's buildings like the Martin Towers. We certainly have equivalents here in Allentown that, whether it's multi-story industrial buildings that will never be used again as industrial buildings and as the economics of them at a point where they will just fall to the redevelopment authority because they are completely unmarketable. That's, I think, going to be one of our big responsibilities. Maybe not now. As you said, Martin Towers got a little bit of ways to go, but should nothing happen there, we got buildings like that too, that they'll reach a point where there's no other answer for them but acquisition and sort of wiping out the past and starting being able to subsidize the reuse by offering that building up for nothing. I think there's a role for us on a policy side, too. The redevelopment, our blighted property process, I feel, is very effective, and it sends the right message, but it's not the most efficient way of acquiring abandoned properties. And I'm not trying to take properties away from responsible owners, but where you have abandoned properties, there are more effective and efficient ways of acquiring them and transferring land to other entities, whether it's through the tax foreclosure process, probably through the tax foreclosure process, but other ways to get at abandoned properties that can be more efficiently and effectively done. And it might be a role for the Redevelopment Authority to help almost put ourselves out of business in a certain respect by getting those tasks done in a way that's most efficient and effective, best use of public resources would be, you know, and then it doesn't fall to us to acquire those kinds of properties because they're handled through different.
Dennis Lieb, Eastern Planning Commission. About 5 years ago, something started at the national level called the National Vacant Property Campaign. I just wondered what your opinion was of it and whether there's anything valuable there that you learned.
I think, in fact, they're the ones having this conversation about reforming tax foreclosure processes and making it easier to get vacant properties back into responsible ownership. The fortunate thing for Allentown, which went back to where I started saying how my job is easier than people might think, is that vacancy is actually not a huge problem for the city of Allentown. Cities like Reading are faced with blocks where you've got two active buildings among 50 that are vacant, and what on earth do you do with those? And they're having to explore some strategies that Allentown doesn't necessarily have to look at as much. We can take from them for the occasional property that we acquire, demolish, and might offer up as a side yard to someone else. We don't have to do that on a large scale, but we can take those best practices and use them in small ways. But I think for a lot of cities that saw the kind of population losses some of those other cities saw and now face, you know, a substantial vacant property, whether it's vacant lots or vacant buildings issue, there are a lot of good ideas that are coming out of that.